This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the hour, call in your composting and cold weather gardening questions. We'll be talking about gardening. But first, there is some good news about the economic bailout bill last week, and it has to do with your health insurance, because tacked on to it was a provision now signed into law that requires additional coverage for mental health treatments. So treatments for drug or alcohol addiction, bipolar, schizophrenia, or depression can all be covered by to the same extent as heart disease or a broken bone. It is being hailed as a landmark law by supporters who have spent over a dozen years trying to get it passed. But what about insurance companies? Might they raise insurance premiums, forcing businesses to foot the bill, or perhaps your own if you're paying for private insurance? And will patients really have the access they need to mental health treatment once and for all? Joining me now to talk about the bill and those questions is my guest, William C. Moyers, Vice President of External Affairs for the Hazelden Foundation and author of Broken, My Story of Addiction and Redemption. Welcome to the program, Mr. Moyers.
Thank you, Ira, for having me on this afternoon.
You're welcome. Let's talk about the highlights of the bill. Give me a couple of the highlights that have impressed you.
Well, the biggest highlight, Ira, is that finally, for the first time, the Congress of the United States and the President recognized that addiction to alcohol and other drugs, and that illnesses such as bipolar disorder and eating disorders, as you mentioned, depression, are chronic diseases that deserve and need to be treated on par with other chronic illnesses. It's taken a lot of hard work and effort over many, many decades, actually, to finally get policymakers to recognize not just that addiction is a disease and a chronic disease, but that it's treatable and that treatment does work. So I'd say that the biggest impact of this legislation is to help remove the stigma by removing obstacles that oftentimes get in the way of people accessing a treatment for these illnesses through their private health care insurance.
So, for example, if I go to the doctor, my insurance company will not be allowed to pay me one level of a copay for mental health and another for a broken bone or something like that.
That's essentially correct in the sense that this legislation does not require insurance companies to cover addiction or mental illness. If they were covering it, then they are required to cover it on par or equally with a broken bone or diabetes or hypertension or asthma. So the bill is really not an end-all. I mean, it's just a major step in the right direction towards shining a bright light into what's been a dark corner of chronic disease, and that's addiction and mental illness.
And what size businesses are we talking about here?
Well, generally any business over 50 employees would be required to cover it if they already cover it. It's not a mandate. There were opponents to the legislation over the years that often said that any mandate from Congress is not a good one, especially one like this, but that's not true. It's only, again, companies that are more than 50 employees and are already covering addictions treatment. And the interesting part about it, Ira, is that oftentimes the argument had been made in the past when we had mental health parity first passed in 1996, legislation that excluded addiction. The argument was made back then that if Congress was to pass legislation, it would probably lead insurance carriers to drop coverage. But the reality is that all these years later, mental illness has been covered in plans that really saw the value of treating employees who have depression or other illnesses. So I suspect that we may see a couple of short blips on the screen in terms of decreases in coverage, but over the long run, we'll see a greater expansion of those coverages.
So do you think that companies that don't cover mental illness might add it on now?
Well, you know, there's always the troubling reality of today's world economically, and who knows what's going to happen with unemployment and health care reform that's coming in 2009, no matter whom we elect as president. There are a lot of sort of intangibles, if you will, but my sense, Ira, is that everybody from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to the Better Business Bureau and Fortune 500 companies and small mom-and-pop hardware stores have all recognized the reality that addiction and mental illness don't discriminate, that they affect the corner office just like they affect the assembly line, and that it's best to treat these illnesses so that they can retain their employees, so that the workplace is a safer place. and so that the home front is a safer place as well. So I think by and large, we've helped to shine, as I said earlier, a bright light into this dark corner of misunderstanding, and helped people to understand that, you know, these are illnesses that can be treated and that treatment works and that people who get treatment are all the better for it, and so is the community.
Here's a question from Paxis and Second Life, and the question is, will insurers now be able to refuse your application if you have a family history of mental illness?
Well, I don't think I know the question, the answer to that. Yeah. That's a good question. I mean, there are certainly pre-existing conditions that oftentimes help to decide who gets coverage and who doesn't for any number of illnesses. I suppose that case could be made. But, you know, the reality is I'm a recovering addict and alcoholic. I have 14 years of continuous sobriety, and I'm very open and honest about my addiction to those mood and mind-altering substances and to my long-term recovery, which came because I got treatment. I think people who are willing to share that with their employers, willing to share that with their doctors and their communities, actually are in a healthy space of mind, body, and spirit. And I would think that that would be a good thing to be able to talk about that, not a negative.
1-800-989-8255, talking with William C. Moyers, Vice President of External Affairs for the very famous Hazelden Foundation. He's also author of Broken, My Story of Addiction and Redemption. Do you think that addiction treatment is becoming a bipartisan issue now?
Well, there's no question about it, Ira. Addiction is a bipartisan disease, and the solution demands a bipartisan approach. For many, many years, Republicans thought that Democrats were the addicted ones, and Democrats thought it was the Republicans who needed treatment. But the reality is that this is an illness that has reached across both aisles of Congress. The president signed the bill into law. There were a lot of members of both parties and both houses who supported it. And I'll tell you, we have a terrible problem in this country with a criminal justice system and a war on drugs that's not that's trying to deal with the problem by locking people up and holding them accountable only in a criminal justice kind of way. And I think taxpayers, Republicans, and Democrats are all waking up to the reality that we need a new approach. And among the many tools in this new approach is one that holds people accountable by getting them treatment. So this is a cost-saving step by Congress.
You know, many times Congress people change their minds when it hits their own home. Particular examples might be in embryonic stem cell research, where you had conservative people in Congress switching their votes or coming out in favor of it because they knew people who might need the technology that comes out of it. Or they had relatives who might benefit from the research that might come out of it. So it was a very personal thing to them. Did you find that in winning over converts in this case, too?
Yes, Ira. I have found in my own visits to Capitol Hill, through my work at Hazelden, and also with my colleagues in the field, Faces and Voices of Recovery, and the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, and other organizations that have been pushing this legislation, I discovered that addiction is the chronic illness that thrives in the shadows of private shame and public misunderstanding. And when I stand up and speak out, and when others stand up and speak out and share their own experiences, we find Republicans and Democrats alike, people from the rural lands and people from the inner city, all discovering that they too can talk about it. And I will say that I believe there has been an emergence in this country, in the media, in Washington, and elsewhere, in terms of talking about addiction and mental illness as treatable illnesses.
So what is the next step? Would a logical next step be to get more coverage by health insurance companies?
Sure. I mean, it would be wonderful if it's more than that, though, Ira. Mm-hmm. Yes, we want insurance companies to step up to the plate as they will now and do their part. But I think the bigger challenges, there are two of them quickly. One of them is, how do we include addiction and mental illnesses in the larger conversation about health care reform, which is surely coming in this country in 2009 and certainly in 2010? We need to make sure that those illnesses are at the table and not on the table. And secondly, I think we need to use this as an opportunity to have a national dialogue about how we change the war on drugs so that we more equitably balance intervention and tough law enforcement with prevention, research, and treatment, in part because the saddest thing about this is, Ira, there are still 20 to 25 million people in this country, so say the federal government, 20 to 25 million people who need treatment, but only 25% of them ever get it, either through their private insurance or in a public pay system. There's too much of a gap between the need and the resources.
Mm-hmm. So you feel this could be a good bipartisan campaign issue?
Well, it's a huge step in the right direction. And in fact, both candidates, Senator McCain and Senator Obama, have talked very passionately about their own familial experiences with alcoholism and drug addiction. And Senator McCain has talked about his father and his struggles with addiction. And, of course, Senator Obama has talked about his own experimentation as a younger man and also some of the impact that those substances have had in his family. So I think this country is a lot further along now than we were even just a couple of weeks ago, but we have a long way to go.
One last question about the specifics of the law. Does the new law put a cap on the number of visits, you know, like it used to be for treatments?
Well, it's not a carte blanche, certainly not, and it shouldn't be. Healthcare reform needs to be conscious, or healthcare needs to be conscious of controlling costs even while offering good treatments. The bottom line with the bill is that it says that co-pays and deductibles and annual and lifetime caps on addiction and mental health benefits will be the same as those on medical and surgical benefits. In other words, no more and no less. And I think that's the key. The discrimination against mental illness and addiction have been ended because of this legislation.
And when does it take effect?
It takes effect 1 year from when Congress voted on it, which I believe was October the 3rd. So we've got about a year. Nobody get worried yet. We've got a year to figure out exactly what it means and how it's going to work. But for all intents and purposes, it'll probably be early 2010 before all insurance plans are on board and all consumers understand their rights as well as their needs.
William, I want to thank you very much for taking time to be with us.
Thanks for having me on, Ira.
You're welcome. William C. Moyers is the Vice President of External Affairs for the Hazelden Foundation, author of Broken, My Story of Addiction and Redemption. That's a book he's written recently. We're going to take a short break and come back and switch gears and talk to you about gardening. Yeah, your garden's looking a little brown, right? It's the end of the summer. Things are cooling down a little bit. It doesn't mean you have to stop gardening. You can actually start working on compost and start working on that compost, rich compost, right there in a bucket in your kitchen using worms. But you didn't know that. You knew the worms were good for your soil. Now you can help them really make great soil. We'll tell you how to do that. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The weather is getting chillier. The leaves are turning and the boxes and boxes of apples are being trucked into the market. Maybe you're going out apple picking this weekend. And you home gardeners have probably plucked those last of the summer tomatoes on the vine, or maybe they're just beginning to finish up ripening like they are on mine. But, you know, just because it's windy and rainy and autumn is signaling us outside, it does not mean that's the end of your gardening season. One of my guests today harvests a bounty of vegetables all year long, even up there in the snows of Maine. She's here to talk about four-season gardening and answer your calls and questions on prepping your veggie plot for cold weather. And we're going to talk also with my other guest about one of the most important ingredients for a bumper crop in your backyard plot, and that is rich black compost. And with a little bit of care, you can put your potato peels, your coffee grounds, your yard clippings, your eggshells to work in your garden instead of sending those scraps out to the landfill to sit for ages in those black plastic bags. But you may not have a lot of time on your hands, so how much work does it take to do the compost? Probably less than you think, and we'll talk about one way you can do it right there in your kitchen and include worms in the process to help you get that compost going. So we want to hear about your gardening questions. We have some suggestions for you for veggies year-round. Maybe you're trying to figure out why your compost heap you started last year, this is very common, why it just is not working, right? It's like you're not getting the compost you need. Well, we'll give you an answer. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Barbara Damrosch is the co-owner of Four Seasons Farm up there in Maine. She's also a gardening columnist for the Washington Post and author of The Garden Primer. She's here in our New York studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much. Wonderful to be here.
And that's the Four Season Farm up in Maine. Where in Maine is that?
It's about two-thirds of the way up the coast in the town of Brooksville on a little peninsula called Cape Rozier. It's not far from Mount Desert National Park.
Wow, that's a great spot. Also with us is Deborah Martin, co-author of The Complete Compost Gardening Guide. She joins us from Allentown, Pennsylvania, not too far away. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, Barbara, first, at the Four Season Farm up there in Maine, do you garden all year round? Can you grow things all year round?
We harvest all year round.
Right?
During the dead of winter, there isn't much gardening going on because the weeds aren't growing. There's no bugs to think about. The evaporation rate is not very great because of the low angle of the sun, so we're not really watering. We're really just picking.
And you're picking it.
It's growing a little bit. But yeah. When the day slows down so that it's below 10 hours of sun above the horizon, mm-hmm. then growth very much slows. But that doesn't stop you from harvesting what you've already gotten in the ground.
Let's talk about some of the ABCs for people getting their fall gardens ready. What should they do?
Well, just to sort of put the garden to bed, I think one of the wonderful things you can do is, first of all, clean up any debris, any weeds, get it really kind of good housekeeping, mm-hmm. pristine, and then put down a couple of inches of well-rotted manure or good compost, and just let the freezing and thawing, assuming you have some freezing in your climate,
right.
Open up cracks in the soil and kind of mellow in that topping that you've added. And that way, when you get ready to plant in spring, everything will be ready. You know how in the springtime, you're kind of impatient, but often the
right.
ground is too soggy?
Right.
If you don't have to till or dig or anything like that, you can just maybe stick in a row of peas without worrying about that.
Now, what if I want to harvest like you do? I want to harvest veggies all winter. What do I have to do?
Well, you have to sow crops really starting in September, October. There's still time, especially if you live in a slightly mild part of the country, to sow a lot of greens like lettuce and spinach and corn salad, a wonderful little California weed, or miner's lettuce. Miner's lettuce is the California weed. Mm-hmm. Corn salad is another word for mosh, which mm-hmm. is so hardy you could practically grow on icebergs. Any of the Asian greens, baby Swiss chard, beet leaves, beet greens, these are all things that are very happy when
but
it's cool.
But you can't just put them in the ground and leave them there.
Well, if you're in the South, you could.
Yes.
Winter's your garden season very
right.
often down there
right.
because it's your summers that you have to struggle through.
Mm-hmm.
Up where I live, we have to use either cold frames, which is just a bottomless box on the ground with a glass lid that you vent to keep it from cooking your greens.
Yeah, they'll get that warm.
Oh, yes. You really have to worry more about too hot than too cold.
In the middle of the winter, the cold frame will stay warm.
Depending on the crops, of
right.
course. Something like mosh or spinach, just a cold frame alone would be fine. And also things like some of the fresh dug root crops like leeks and carrots. Carrots love to be frosted a bit. They taste so sweet that we call them candy carrots.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's great. 1-800-989-8255, talking about gardening. Let's talk to Deborah Martin for a moment. What about building a worm box? I talked about this composting. What is a worm box for composting?
Well, Ira, if you want to keep composting all year round, and especially through the winter months when maybe you don't want to make a trek out to your compost bin to empty out a few kitchen scraps, you can set up a worm bin in your home. Using a plastic storage container, about 14 gallons or a little bit bigger, and you can make a nice home for the worms in there and feed them two or three times a week. They'll eat, a few pounds of kitchen wastes, and they like coffee grounds and other things, peelings.
Well, doesn't that smell awful?
No, it does not smell awful. If things are in balance, if the worms are in a happy environment, it's moist but not wet, and, they're doing their thing. It doesn't smell bad at all. It smells like moist soil. I think it has kind of a nice fragrance, actually.
And where do you get the worms from?
I bought them at a bait store. I say that I saved them from drowning, actually. But I started my bin with about 200 red worms.
So you don't want to go out in the backyard and dig up the worms?
No. Your free-range worms tend to be night crawlers, the ones that you see in your garden. And they prefer a cooler environment than that worm bin. the worm bin will tend to get a little warm as the things in it begin to decompose. And the red worms are actually manure worms. They typically live in a warmer environment than those earthworms you see outside.
So these farm-raised worms, if I might call them that,
yes,
they live better indoors, and they're used to being crowded, and they're better for your kitchen.
Yes.
And so give me the formula for how you put this all together.
Okay. So you start with a big bin.
Right.
And you drill some holes in it in the sides with a quarter-inch drill bit, mm-hmm. just to give it a little bit of ventilation. You space those about 6 inches apart. You don't want too many, but some, enough to let some air in there. Then you wet sections of newspaper and shred them, just tear them into strips, no more than 3-inch pieces usually, and fill that bin pretty full with strips of wet newspaper, and then mix in a cup of compost and a cup of soil. These are, you know, approximate amounts, but those things give the worms some grit, so they can digest their food. That's something that they need. And then you throw in a cup of cornmeal. That's a starter food for your worms. Mm-hmm. Once you get it all mixed together in the bin, then you can add worms. And like I said, I started with about 200 that I got at the bait store. Something I should mention, too, when you're tearing up that newspaper, it's nice to wear rubber gloves while you're doing that, or else your hands will be really black by the time you're finished.
And how do you know when the worms are ready for your garbage scraps?
It doesn't take long, just a couple of days, and you can kind of monitor the conditions in the bin, which, by the way, should have a lid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense.
And, you know, you can check if there's a lot of condensation under the lid or on the sides of the bin, and if the worms are coming to the top or climbing up the sides, it may be too moist, and perhaps you want to crack the lid open for a day or so to let things dry out, or else mix in some more dry newspaper.
Mm-hmm. What should you not throw in there? What kind of food should you not throw in? Anything?
Okay, yeah. The worms, they seem to not like anything that has the potential to grow in terms of plant parts. So they don't eat seeds.
Mm-hmm.
That's good for us when we're talking about our gardens, but it's not something you want to put into your worm bin. They like coffee grounds, they like tea bags, and they will eat, you know, they don't mind the filters or
right.
the bags. They like peelings, fruit peels, and if you've been, say, making apple pies, the peels from your apples, or if you're making applesauce, all the parts that you're not going to use are good to go into the bin.
Wow.
Eggshells are fine. Bits of bread, crusts maybe that your kids don't eat, or if you have bread that unfortunately has gotten moldy before you were able to use it, that's a great thing for the worms. They don't mind the mold at all.
Hmm.
And cooked vegetables
gotcha.
Are fine as long as they're not really heavily salted or very... you know, buttery or greasy. They don't like onions or onion family plants, and they're not really good with things like citrus rinds. But other than that, they're pretty agreeable.
Barbara, do you have a compost?
Oh,
Do you do that?
I don't do it indoors, but I'm a serious and avid compost maker outside.
You have a chapter in your book on composting.
Oh, it's the magic word.
And you can actually, we have on our website a video from Will Allen, who just won the MacArthur Genius Award last week.
Uh-huh.
We went up and videoed him in Milwaukee when we were did our show there. And on our website, we have a video of him doing composting with worms and how to make a worm tea. How to make the tea out of the worms. You can watch the video, and we call it a potent packed project of fertilizer that comes out of the tea. And he showed us that you can actually make compost heat up, Barbara.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what it's doing. It's the bacteria in your compost pile are creating the heat during the decomposition of the organic matter. That's what makes it all work.
And he was actually lining the sides of his greenhouses outdoors with the hot compost and heating his greenhouses, the hoop greenhouses
sure.
that way.
That's an old technique.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
You ever thought of that, Deborah?
Yes. Yes, it is an age-old process of keeping things warm.
All right, let's see. We have lots of listeners who'd like to ask questions. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to them right now. Let's go out to Denver. Roland in Denver. Hi, Roland.
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a question for Deborah regarding the worm bins.
Okay.
I live in a very small 300 square foot apartment for dead broke grad students.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to worm bin in here. I hate throwing good food out.
Yes.
I mean, it's not food I would eat, but it's worth something.
Mm-hmm.
But I've heard all sorts of rumors about friends trying it and having problems with flies and smelling bad and things to that effect. How do you avoid, basically, maggots?
Okay.
Thanks, Roland.
The main thing is to, keep the bin closed when you're not, getting involved with it, and also to kind of monitor the situation. Fruit flies and fungus gnats can become, problems around a worm bin, and the main thing is to, exclude them from their food sources, and if you need to put up a little trap putting a little bit of, rotting fruit into a jar with some soapy liquid and kind of capturing them. If you notice fly larvae or a pupa on the sides of the bin, scrape them off. And, usually a bin that's well-maintained, and you'll come to know if the worms are happy, if they are doing their thing, because you will see that they're active and you will not notice any off odors. But the other thing is, too, when you put food into the bin, to bury it down into the bedding and then cover it back over again. And that puts it where the worms will find it, and it kind of keeps it from attracting mm-hmm. other pests that maybe you don't want living in that bin.
We're talking about gardening this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Talking with Barbara Damrash and Deborah Martin. Barbara is a gardening columnist for The Washington Post and author of The Garden Primer. And Deborah Martin is co-author of The Complete Compost Gardening Guide. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's talk a little bit more, Barbara, about you have your cold frame set up. You've got your veggies in there. How long can you expect to harvest food from that?
Well, it depends, first of all, on how cold your winters are. But you can also do tricks beyond the cold frame to make it go even further. One of the things we've experimented with is putting a cold frame inside an unheated greenhouse. So that gives you two layers of protection. Each layer makes you a zone and a half south. So inside the greenhouse, you're in New Jersey instead of Maine. And inside the cold frame, you'd be in Georgia. And an even easier way to do it is to put Remay, which is just a brand of floating row cover. That's the generic word for that white spun-bonded polyester material you can put over plants, either for insect protection mm-hmm. or frost protection. That will give it a good layer of protection as well.
How about these water towers we see surrounding?
The wall of waters.
Does that work?
I haven't used them because I have a little bit more efficient ways to go about doing a large number of plants, but I've heard that they are effective.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if lots of folks got questions about gardening. Let's go to Ben in Cincinnati. Hi, Ben.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi there.
I was wondering, I had heard somewhere that for your garden you should put a layer of dead leaves over it in the fall to make sure that your soil is nice and rich in the spring when you're gardening again. Is that true?
Barbara?
Well,
will the leaves decay over the fall?
Probably not completely. Yeah. If you, one of the things you can do is to sort of chop up autumn leaves with a sharp spade into the soil to add some nitrogen. For instance, before a year when you're going to grow brassicas like cabbage or cauliflower, broccoli or kale, they really like to have some autumn leaves chopped up in there. I mean, sometimes people will just put a layer of something like straw or leaves just as a kind of protective blanket,
mm-hmm.
and ultimately they will decay. Whether it would happen in the wintertime when it's cold and there isn't much decomposition going on, I think it might sort of depend.
Mm-hmm. Deborah Martin, composting with your worms, how long does this worm composting take from start to finish?
I've been able to harvest finished worm castings, in other words, worm droppings and compost combined, after about 2 to 3 months of my bin being in operation. And I collected about a gallon or 2 gallons or, thereabouts of finished worm compost that I was able then to put into my garden.
How do you separate the worms out?
Ah, it's a lot of fun. I call it herding worms, and they are very easy pets to tend. They don't have to be walked or, really anything like that. To harvest the compost and not harvest the worms, you need to dump the contents of the bin out onto a tarp or some sheets of newspaper in the sunlight or in a lighted place, and you make kind of a volcano shape out of that pile of material. And the worms don't like the light, and so they go into the middle, and you can gradually then scoop off the top and the sides of your cone and keep making a smaller and smaller cone and scooping off. And then you do want to sift that stuff that you scoop off through a colander or something catch any remaining worms that you might have missed.
Let me interrupt because we have to take a short break.
Sure.
And we'll come back and talk lots more with Barbara Damrosch and Deborah Martin. So stay with us. We'll talk gardening after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about how to tend a garden in chilly weather and how to make your own rich, dark compost at home. My guests are Barbara Damrosch, co-owner of the Four Season Farm up in Maine. She's also a gardening columnist for the Washington Post and author of The Garden Primer. Also, Deborah Martin is here. She is co-author of The Complete Compost Gardening Guide. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Barbara, you're up there on the coast of Maine. There's got to be a lot of seaweed.
Yes.
I hear that's great compost.
It's great.
Great compost.
Yeah, it washes up on the road in big storms. And if you put it on your compost pile, it decomposes wonderfully. It's a good source of nitrogen and all kinds of trace elements, which are very important for plant health. And you could even put it right into the garden and dig it in.
Are there any other things that wash up that could be used for compost, like shells or anything?
Shells are wonderful. Things like clam shells might take 100 years to break down, but that's fine.
Yeah.
That's like a long-acting vitamin pill. Things like crustaceans,
right,
like lobster shells and crab wastes, we use those in the compost all the time, and those break down really quickly.
Can you just dig them into the soil to break up the soil, or is that not a good idea?
You could. It's a little hard work, I think. We actually do often till them in.
Mm-hmm.
At first, the seagulls will peck at them, but once they're a day old, they won't bother them. And when we put them on the compost pile, we'll often bury them just so that the seagulls and the crows don't come down and make a mess.
Hmm. So Deborah, if you're having your lobster dinner, then it's a good thing to take the shell and throw it in there.
Oh yes, absolutely.
To your kitchen composter.
Yes, you know, the more diverse the materials that you put into your compost, the more nutrients and the greater diversity of nutrients will come out in your finished compost to be available for your garden plants. So, the more stuff you put in, the better.
Jim in Cincinnati. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Good evening or afternoon. How are you all?
How are you?
Good. I've been worm composting for 12 or 15 years, and it is just so easy.
What was your hardest thing to learn to get it right?
There was nothing to learn. I read a book. We had an old 55 half-gallon or whiskey barrel. We filled it up with shredded leaves. We put the worms in there, and then we would use our kitchen scraps, and we would start off at, let's say, 12 o'clock. Bury the scraps there. Next time we would bury them at 2 o'clock, 6 o'clock. Work all the way around in a circle, and by the time we got to the first 12 o'clock, all those scraps had been eaten and the worms had moved on. And you just continually do that, and it was easy. There's no work to it. You just bury it, cover it, and let it go, and the worms do all the work for you.
Where did you keep your barrel?
We kept it in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
Just it was too big to keep in the kitchen.
Yeah, you're doing it big time.
It was just that's what we had available, and we used a plastic bag that we tied a rope around it as a cover because we didn't have a tight-fitting cover, but that still presented no problems, and we just generated worm manure every few months, and it was fabulous.
All right, Jim, thanks for calling.
Okay.
Good luck to you. 1-800-989-8255, a satisfied customer. Someone who, obviously, it's not as difficult. I think people are worried about the odor. They're worried about worms getting the source. And you say you can get it at the bait shop.
Right.
I think it's a great idea to do worms inside.
Mm-hmm. Barbara, how do you actually figure out what you're doing wrong in your garden if you have this, say you have the cold frame or whatever, if things are not working out over the winter?
Well,
what's the biggest mistake
that
the amateur gardener is making when he tries to set up a cold frame or Is it that they're cooking? They're actually cooking
the
veggies?
I mean,
it's getting too hot in there?
That's the worst mistake. And believe me, I've done it too.
They don't realize how hot the sun is coming through the glass.
Because the whole point of a cold frame is that the earth takes in sunlight and then radiates the heat back at night. Mm-hmm. And you want to keep that light, that hotness in there.
Right.
But then once the sun comes out in the daytime, it can be too much of a good thing. So we usually use a little notch stick to prop it open. If we're going out for the day,
right,
it's better to prop it open and go away and leave it on the cold side than the other way around.
Now, I noticed you didn't mention in your cold frame using other cold weather veggies. I would think of in the broccoli family, for example,
mm-hmm,
you know, broccoli or cauliflower, things like that.
You know, I haven't found that they do all that well in the wintertime, or kale. And those do well just as fall garden crops. I mean, we often have had kale almost up until Christmas time and Brussels sprouts at Christmas time. But they don't respond well to being inside a cold frame after that.
Mm-hmm.
The small crops, if you do lettuce, do it as baby leaf lettuce where you cut and comb it, you know, and it regrows.
Right.
Don't do the big heads.
Huh? Good point. Jerry in Tallahassee. Hi, Jerry.
Yes.
Hi.
Hey.
You're next.
Thank you. Great show.
Thank you.
I've got a rather elemental question, though. The city is doing a great job down here of promoting recycling and has provided some compost bins to residents.
No kidding.
Yeah. Not free, but cheap. And now the question is, where to locate a compost bin? I've got a concrete slab I could put it on, or I've got a bare patch of earth that's up closer to the house, right up next to the house. What would be a good location, and where does one put a compost bin?
Deborah, you're the author of the Complete Compost Gardening Guide. Where should he put it?
Ah, well, Jerry, I would tell you that you want to put that bin as close to where you want to use the compost as you possibly can. And the other thing is to make it convenient to be able to take materials and put into it. So access is important. Don't tuck it away and hide it, because then you'll forget about it, or you won't want to carry things to it and carry finished compost from it. You don't need to put it in the sun. In fact, if it's in a slightly shady spot, that will help to keep it moist, to keep it from drying out too much.
The bare earth spot is in the shade.
Okay, yeah, I would go bare earth, because, you know, it's got an open bottom, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to, you know, you'll then improve that spot underneath where the bin is. And eventually you may want to, you know, move that bin someplace else, and you'll have a great enriched place where you can, you know, plant something else.
Does it need to be elevated at all?
It does not.
Okay. You know,
does he need to stir it up a lot?
It depends on how fast you want things to happen and, you know, what you're putting into it.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, if you mix in, you know, a sort of a combination of dry things and wet things, you know, some people will say green things or brown things. But if you combine those ingredients as you are adding them to the bin, there's not as much need for stirring.
Mm-hmm.
But if you notice that it's getting soggy, or if you notice that it's smelly, you want to, you know, get a stick or something and poke around and aerate that, or use a pitchfork and, you know, let some air in there. And that will help to put to work the decomposers that work with oxygen, and it'll smell better then.
Thanks, Jerry. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Are you finding a lot more towns are giving or selling composting bins?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
That's
a lot of places.
But you don't have to have a bin, right?
Oh, no. No, you can simply pile things up on the ground, or you can make a container out of wire fencing, or you can make a container using wooden shipping pallets,
mm-hmm,
you know, fastened together.
Yeah.
But you don't have to have any kind of a container. You can just pile stuff up, or even bury it, you know, dig a pit and put it down in the ground, too.
You agree, Barbara?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Compost pit works fine.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about making a pit.
Sure.
It's so common sense. I just pile the stuff. And grass clippings are great, too, for compost heap.
Yeah, they really heat it up.
Well, talk about heating up. Do you need a certain ingredient, like a nitrogen? Does it have to have a lot of nitrogen to heat up?
Well, you know what you need is you need two things. You need high nitrogen things, and these are sort of the green, moist things like grass clippings and weeds and kitchen wastes and manure. And then you need the carbonaceous things, the high carbon things like straw or little twigs, leaves, things like that. And it's the fire and the fuel. The green stuff like grass clippings are the fire, and the brown stuff is the fuel. And it's the action between the two that makes it cook.
Interesting. We're talking about gardening this hour, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. So you got that's an interesting thing you meant. You have to balance the ingredients.
If you, you put a lot of dry stuff in, you want to put some of that green moist stuff on top, or the seaweed. That would be
a
good one.
And, and I hear people throw sawdust into their compost.
Yes.
What does that supply it with, Deborah?
That's a carbon source, and so you do need to mix in something like grass clippings or wet kitchen scraps, something green and moist to balance out that very dry and high carbon sawdust.
Sally in Grand Rapids. Hi, Sally.
Hi.
Hi there.
I have a question about my worm bin. I am wondering if I can put in computer paper or paper that has colored printing ink on it, or if that will harm my worms.
Like the funnies? Sunday funnies?
The funnies, or, something that I printed on my color printer at my home
your
office.
Your inkjet ink. Will that hurt the...
In general, most paper and most inks are safe for the worms. You might look and see what the, if you have any information about what the ink is made of, but colored inks, most inks that are available to consumers and are used in newspapers are soy-based anymore. And so it's not a concern at all for the worms.
Thanks, Sally.
Great.
Have a good weekend. Can you grow, Barbara, can you also grow flowers?
In the wintertime?
In the wintertime? Is that possible at all inside
We have tried that a little bit in the greenhouse. In our climate, they stopped blooming. Even things like calendula, which are very, very hardy. The light level was too low for bloom. The Johnny Jump Ups were the only thing that really kept right on going.
And they'll tell you to cut back. I was out cutting my roses back a little bit, and they'll say to cut back all the seed pods off the bushes. You're giving me a frown on that one, not to do that.
Well, there's a different philosophy about cutting back things. Now, my outdoor gardens, my perennial gardens. I used to be, Miss Neat and Tidy, and I'd go cut everything down to the ground, and I felt so, organized and clean, good housekeeper. And I don't do that anymore. I leave a lot of them standing. Anything that has a good, strong stem, I leave standing for seeds for the birds, nesting and cover for the birds. And it looks beautiful that way. All these catch the snow in different ways. Like an ornamental grass would look different with snow on it than a sedum with that big fluffy sort of snowball head of white. And it's something to look at. The garden looks alive even in the middle of winter when I do that. And then first warm days I get out there and I have this wonderful job of gradually cutting it all back as the new little green nubbins are coming up again.
Terrific. Talking about gardening this hour, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Talking with Barbara Damrosch, who is a co-owner of the Four Season Farm up in Maine. She's also a gardening columnist for the Washington Post and author of The Garden Primer. Deborah Martin, co-author of The Complete Compost Gardening Guide, 1-800-989-8255. Wanda in Mountain View, hi.
Hi, I have a 9-year-old daughter, and she's interested in gardening. We have a garden, and I've been thinking about starting a worm bin with her. And I'm wondering if you have any suggestions of children's books that would help her understand what a worm bin is like and what happens and what the worms look like and what they do and that sort of thing.
Well, I would have to go to my local library and check on that. But I have to say that, sort of the classic guide to worm composting is called Worms Eat My Garbage by Mary Applehoff. And although it's not a children's book, it is really quite an excellent reference and the standard that most people use when they're really serious about getting into worm composting. But it's a great project to do with your kids.
Sounds great. Good luck to you.
Okay, thank you.
1-800-989-8255. I've got some few questions from Second Life here. They're very interesting questions. Let me get to them, and I'll put them all in. I'll wrap them all up into one. We have... one from Tech Wraith Daling says, can you turn your worm bin into a planter? Can you just drop seeds or seedlings in and stick it in the sun, I guess, and let the seeds grow out of it later on? Someone, Selectra Darwin, says, can you grow mushrooms in the same bin that the worms are in?
I think if you put your worm bin out in the sun to grow plants in it, you would probably spell the demise of the worms then. They tend not to do too well in that kind of a really warm environment. But, if you're done tending the worms you know, the worms will themselves become part of the compost, and not in any kind of way that would be, you know, horrifying to you. You won't find worm carcasses. They'll just sort of meld into the stuff in the bin.
Right.
So, you know, if you've done your science fair project and you want to just convert the worms and their compost into a planter, you could do that. It might be a little bit rich for flowers. You might get more, you know, plants than flowers. But depending on what you're growing, it would be a pretty high nitrogen kind of environment.
Mm-hmm. Barbara, any comment on that? No. How do you know? That's interesting that you bring this up when we talk about the compost. How do you know when it's ready to do what? You know, to be used in the garden, Barbara.
Well, I think when it looks like soil, when it looks like the best soil you've ever seen, rich black gold, then usually it's ready. When you can't distinguish what those original ingredients were, then it's finished compost.
I think people find it hard to believe that it will look like that.
I know. And they're so excited when they do it. Hey, I made compost. And it's very easy.
And then you don't use it as soil, but as a soil appendage.
You want to have as much organic matter in your soil as possible. A farmer considers it good if he or she has 4% organic matter. We've gotten our farm up to 10%, and it grows great vegetables.
And so next spring you put it on, or should you put it on this fall, as you said earlier?
Either. Whatever you have it, put it on. When you've taken out one crop and you're sowing another one, put it on.
Mm-hmm.
Compost is nature's gift to the gardener.
That's mm-hmm. right.
Deborah, you agree with how to use it?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And, you know, your nose is a good judge of when that compost is ready, too. If it just smells like moist soil, then it's good. It's ready. If it smells a little funky yet, put it back. Let it cook some more. And if you still have a few chunks, but most of it seems ready, sift those chunks out and use them to start a new pile.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. And you'll get a good amount.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
At the end of the last few months, should take a few months.
Yes.
And is it the warmer it is, the faster it will produce, or the temperature really doesn't matter?
Most of the decomposers work better when the temperatures are, you know, above freezing. But some of them work at cool temperatures. Some work at, you know, modest temperatures. And mm-hmm. some work when it's really very warm outside. So, you know, you can have a whole range. During the cold winters, things slow down pretty much.
Yeah.
But, you know, during the summer, things are cooking along. And that is heat from those decomposers, not from the outside air so much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
You're very welcome.
Deborah
Thank
Martin,
you.
Co-author of The Complete Compost Gardening Guide, and Barbara Damrosch, co-owner of the Four Season Farm up there in Maine, also a gardening columnist for The Washington Post and author of The Garden Primer. If you have comments or questions, you can write to us at Science Friday, 4 West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036, or surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Flora's got our Sci-Fry Pick of the Week video up there. It's a giant pumpkin. You know these people who grow these giant pumpkins? We've got Flora went out and watched one of the growers. And I won't surprise you, there's an ending to it. There's a happy ending to this contest that he is in. And you'll watch him how he takes care of his giant pumpkin. And it's a great holiday video. It's good for the whole year, too. Also, we're podcasting and blogging. Look, maybe you have some gardening videos you'd like to send it. Well, just click on the link and tell us how we can get your video. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flato in New York.